good about being the last speaker is that we have all the time for you now. I think I understand I have the whole night, right? So, and what is also good is that everyone is tired, and you are already sleepy, so no, I can say whatever I want and no one will be attentive. Okay, so that's a good encouragement. And this is a very, complex topic and certainly a very hot topic. And that is Israel and, of course, Islam. I will touch along the way, issue with Islam. It's interesting, I was listening to John Pauline. I was tempted at the end to have some response, but since I have my time, so along the way, I will say a few words. What is interesting about John Pauline and myself when we talk about this topic is that we sing the same choir, even if we don't use the same voice. We don't sing the same voice, and you will notice that. And I think that is what makes, of course, the choir hearable. Okay, because if we sing with the same voice, then you don't have the harmony and which you would expect. So let me just then go right away into our topic: Israel in eschatological prophecy. Of course, a very important topic because of history. What we are these days, what we are observing these days, especially here in this continent, the influence of dispensationalism, and Israel being, of course, playing an important role, of course, on the news. As far as I'm concerned, of course, there is a personal element into that study, and you will understand that yourself along the way if you haven't. And that doesn't mean, of course, the fact that there is historical interest or personal interest that what you are going to say is wrong. It simply makes what you are going to say more relevant, and it makes the tone of your voice perhaps more passionate when you feel involved in that particular topic. Okay, so this I would like to start with a few definitions, so that we know what we are talking about. Definition about eschatology, definition about Israel, eschatological Israel. We have a number of Israel. See, already, you have noticed that the issue is complex. When we talk about the remnant, who is the remnant? And well, some people are adamant this is only that, other people are less adamant about that. But when you look at the scriptures, it is very clear. You have a number of Israels. You have the biblical Israel. You have later on, look at not only at the scriptures, but the history. Right? Not only the Bible, but also history. When you use the word Israel, you may have a number of concepts, ideas in mind. You have, of course, the biblical Israel, the Israel of the Old Testament, Hebrew Scriptures, the New Testament, the New Testament people belonging to that Israel also. We have later on the Jewish Israel. Then we have political Israel today, the State of Israel, that has complicated, of course, the discussion. And then we have a Christian Israel, the other Israel. Which is, by the way, from a Jewish point of view, an interesting point, because for Jews, Christians were considered as being Israel. I just want to mention here one text by Maimonides, who is one of the greatest Jewish theologians from the Middle Age. And he, when he was teaching about Christianity, at the end of his book, Mishneh Torah, he simply says that Christians are the only community of faith to whom Jews could teach Torah. That's quite interesting. For Jews and Christians share a common revelation in a unique way. And of course, Maimonides lived in a Muslim country. Most of the people around him were Muslim, so he had to make also an argument in regards to Muslims. And he said, well, versus the Muslims, of course, primary text is the Quran. So there is a common text between Christians and Jews, which you don't have when you talk with a Muslim. Although it is right that in the Quran they are referring to the Bible, but not for them the Bible is not really their scriptures. So that would be what I call the other Israel. And I have also a quotation by Irving Greenberg, who says this. Irving Greenberg is an Orthodox rabbi, still alive right now. He's considered as the greatest spokesman of Judaism these days in North America. And Irving Greenberg says, only Christians may be deemed to be members of the people Israel, even as they practice different religions than Jewry does. As you can, the reason why I'm just referring to this quotations from Jewish people is just to tell you that when you talk about Israel, it's very complex. Even when a Jew speaks about Israel, he may have in mind even Christians. It is possible. Now, we have a fifth Israel, which would be the eschatological Israel, and this will be our topic tonight. What is the eschatological Israel? What do we mean by that? And so we need to define eschatology. Well, of course, when you use the word eschatology, what do we mean? We focus on the end, time. We have a historical perspective. We don't have a theological perspective. Eschatology is not a theological concept. It's not an abstract idea. Eschatology deals with time. Eschatology deals with a period of time which happens to be the time of the end. So, this is what eschatology is about, first of all. So, very important attention, okay? Very important moment. The end. Of course, the end is very important, right? The end of everything is important. When someone is dying and he's going to say his last words, they are the most important words. Right? So the conclusion is always the most important word. And this is perhaps why we have the book of Revelation. I don't know. All right? So, but we have also the book of Malachi in the Hebrew scriptures, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So, we have... So it's what gives why is the end important is because the end gives sense to history. It's only at the end that you know, right? This is why Ecclesiastes says, the end is better than the beginning, because at the end you understand. In the beginning you don't know, you don't understand. Only when you reach the end, then suddenly history makes sense. So eschatology is a very important, I believe, very important element of theological reflection, because this is the moment, this is of course the place where we are supposed to try to understand the meaning of history, the meaning of what has been said in the past. So the end is very important, and I would say that in that sense the whole Bible is eschatological. I have a number, we don't have time to get into that, but I believe, for specific reasons, exegetical ones, that the whole Bible actually is eschatological. The key to understand the Bible is eschatological. It starts with creation, it ends with recreation, and that's the structure of the canonical document, a structure which is repeated also in the New Testament, and which is also repeated in the poem about faith in Hebrews 11. So, the whole Bible is eschatological from the beginning to the end. It looks forward to a new future, to the final eschaton, when God will make all things new. So that's the direction of the Bible. If you take that purpose, if you take that eschaton out of the Bible doesn't make sense anymore. The Bible is no longer relevant, doesn't really play its role. So the stories run from the creation of the world to the recreation of the world in the new heaven and the new earth, and that is the kingdom of God. From Abraham to Moses, to prophets, to the apostles, we could say that the people who are writing the Bible are writing with that eschaton. This is the engine of their writing. This is really what is the nerve of the whole Bible, I believe. The God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament, is called Yahweh, which is the future. God defines himself as the God of the future. It's interesting when you talk about Ehi Asher Ehi, I will be who I will be. Actually, this is a paraphrase, a distortion of an Egyptian phrase. Actually, you know that Moses grew up in Egypt, and in Egypt, one of the key phrases was about the God, I, the one, I. So the one in the present, what characterizes really the God of the Bible is, it's not the God of the present, it's the God of the future. It changes suddenly the present has become a future, and the God of the New Testament, of course, Jesus, is the one who is defined as the one who will come. And the Lord's Supper, one of the purposes of the Lord's Supper is to do that Lord's Supper until he comes. This is really what makes sense in the Lord's Supper. It's not that it's not because to have a good meal or to have a moment of a mystical experience. Actually, this the purpose, the goal, the raison d'etre of the Lord's Supper is eschatological. So eschatology is important within the scriptures. Now, eschatological Israel, that is, what do we mean by that? And that is really the Israel in eschatological prophecy. So we need to find here a definition here. That is the Israel of the end. So when you say the word eschatological Israel, you mean the Israel which is of the end. Not only this Israel is of the end, that means it's an Israel which belongs to the time of the end, but it's also an Israel which is supposed to work for the end. So, in other words, what makes eschatological Israel is really eschatological is that it has to be, the raison d'etre of the eschatological Israel is that he has to prepare for the kingdom of God. This is a group of people. You know, I'm using the word Israel, of course, as you can see. This is the way we understand this eschatological Israel. This is a movement, let's call it that way, because we don't want to use confessional labels, although I will touch that issue a little later on. But this is a movement which belongs to the time of the end and which works for the end. It's not just someone a movement which belongs to that moment of human history. This is also a movement who works towards the end, who has a special mission, a movement who has received a special, who has been elected for a special mission. In a way, when you use the word eschatological Israel, you can say I just want us to be careful here, because it may sound a bit confessional. Eschatological Israel can only be an Adventist Israel. When I use the word Adventist, by the way, I'm not using Adventist having in mind you people. I am using the word Adventist in its etymological meaning. That is a movement which is supposed to work towards the Adventists, towards the coming. So this is what characterizes the eschatological Israel. The elected, it's an Israel which is at the time of the end, and which has been elected for a mission which is also eschatological. And that's logical, because you cannot be called to work for the end if you are not at the end. I just want to talk about the issue of election. Eschatological Israel has been elected for an eschatological mission. Prepare for the kingdom, being at the end, and prepare for the kingdom. Just a few words about a reflection about election. I have here with me a quotation I'm taking from a Jewish scholar, Yeshayahu Leibovitch. He says, talking about Israel, of course, he's not talking about the Israel we are talking about right now, but he's talking about the people of Israel in general from his own perspective as a Jew. And he's reflecting about election. And I found this reflection, this definition of election, is very insightful and can be very inspiring for us. The people of Israel is not. Now, this is, by the way, again, this is an Orthodox Jew, all right, who is very well situated in the Jewish city. The people of Israel is not the chosen people, but the people who receives the commandment to be chosen. You know, if you see the nuance, very important nuance, very insightful. There is no particularity in their essence. Their particularity is found only in the requirement that is given to them. What makes the people of Israel, and let's say the people of Israel you identify with, all right, the remnant, we could say. What makes the remnant chosen? It's not because of what it is, it's because of the mission. It's the mission that makes the remnant remnant. It's the mission of eschatological mission that makes Israel eschatological. So chosen for a mission. Now I'm taking that definition and apply it, of course, to our problem here. Mission that makes it, it is the mission that makes it elected. There is no privilege there. There is no superiority. There is no ethnic superiority. There is not even ethical superiority. And I want to say further, there is no even intellectual or, theological superiority in a way. It's the mission. And as far as we fulfill that mission, then we are chosen. We are chosen for a mission. We are not chosen for what we are. We are chosen for what we are supposed to do. So it is the mission that makes it, that makes really worthy. Now, what is the role of that? I have two questions and I would like to then to address these two questions. Two questions then. What is the role of and the mission of eschatological Israel? By eschatological Israel, you have understood what I mean. I mean the Israel of the end. What you would call in your language the remnant people, in the way we have defined in our conversation just before, right? People who is situated at the end, we belong to the time of the end, we believe that we belong to the time of the end, but therefore we are, and I'm using the first person in the plural, and you understand what I mean, we are the people who are situated in the time of the end. But also, our mission is eschatological in the sense that we are preparing for the kingdom of God, which is, of course, a kingdom which is supposed to bring the end of human history. So this is the first question we want to ask is, what is the mission of this eschatological Israel? Okay? And then the second question, which you will see in time, now there is some kind of relationship to that. What is the role of Jewish Israel in that kind of mission in connection to that eschatological Israel? What is the mission, the role, the function of Jewish Israel? And even, let's say it, political Israel, the state of Israel. These are important questions we have to address, because these are questions which are really put on in the debate these days, and with the dispensationalism there, and also the state of Israel. These are questions which are relevant and deserve our attention. So the first question then, the identity and the mission of the eschatological Israel. That is, again, Israel at the end time. The Israel which precedes the coming of the Messiah and who works in that direction, works on behalf of that coming. Well, many movements, of course, could identify themselves as such, as you may know. You know, I was just listening the other day to a speech which was given by, forgot his name now, Farrakhan. I punished myself the whole evening. I was just listening to the whole speech. And he identified himself with the eschatological Israel. So you have many movements, and you would like to know now, of course, I'm just giving you that example because it speaks to you better, but we have many movements who identify themselves. Eschatological movement. But of course, this is not enough to say, I am, and therefore I am. Right? So there must be some kind of criteria to identify the right one in that context. So we have... we have, of course, a Seventh-day Adventist. Of course, our key text is Daniel 8:14, which we are using to say, look, historically, coming from that text, 2300 in the morning, this is the moment after that, 1844, this is our birth, birth time, you know. So we are the time of the end. Of course, we could discuss that, and I didn't want to address this text in other places. But what I would like to do tonight with you is to take one key text, which was mentioned by John Pauline, interestingly, at the end of his presentation. So this will be our text tonight. So this is exactly the way Daniel, you know, did. The book of Daniel ended with a message, and the book of Revelation starts with that message. So I'm doing the reverse right now. Okay, so we have in the three traditions. Let's read, first of all, the key text, Malachi 4, 5 to 6. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have, these beautiful techniques, PowerPoint, etc., to entertain you. You will have to endure my smile and my Gaelic accent. And so, I hope you will, I will get through to you anyway. So, Malachi, last biblical prophet, okay? Alright, it happens that in our Bible, this is the last book, and I'm going to read the text, verse 5 to 6, and we'll come to. Let's start with verse 4, because this is really where it starts. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. It's a text. Even the last words should be listened to. Although we don't like to hear those last words about striking and curse. They are part of the message. So we have to hear the whole thing. We have to swallow the whole pill. So this is what we have here. We are talking about here is Elijah, okay, who is presented as someone who will be a forerunner to the Messiah. Someone who will come and precede the coming of the Messiah. An eschatological figure. And this was recognized as an eschatological figure, by the way, in the three traditions. We all know, of course, the Christian traditions about Elijah, and even in the New Testament, when we sometimes identify Elijah with John the Baptist, but we know that even John the Baptist say about himself, he was not Elijah. And Jesus, although Jesus himself recognizes that there is something of Elijah in John the Baptist, but actually the real Elijah is supposed to come at the end. So he is also emphasizing the fact that Elijah is not really John the Baptist, but he sees an eschatological figure. So you have this in the New Testament, and beyond the New Testament, of course, Christian tradition, including, of course, our Adventist tradition, Elijah is an eschatological figure. But of course, in Judaism and in Islam, also Elijah is an eschatological figure. In Judaism, as you know, Elijah is associated with eschatology. He's the one who is associated at the time of Passover. He's the one who is supposed to speak about the coming of the Messiah. And he's also the one who is evoked at the time of circumcision. So because at the time of circumcision, every Jewish mother is supposed to hold perhaps the Messiah. So Elijah is also present there. And there are many incidents in Judaism where Elijah plays a role. And we are waiting for the coming of Elijah. In Judaism, they are waiting for the coming of Elijah also before the coming of the Messiah. And still in Orthodox Judaism, there are some people who try to identify the Elijah. And of course in Islam, you know, by the way, in Islam, whenever you go to Mecca, you know, to the Hajj, to the pilgrimage, every year that they go there, Elijah appears as a kind of a recurring figure, right, associated with the coming of a change of a new world. Okay, so you can see that Elijah is a very important figure, eschatological figure, and we would like to know what the text is saying here about this Elijah, and we want to ask, why Elijah? What are the characteristics of Elijah? What do we have here? How is Elijah described? So that we can understand perhaps something about the nature of what we are dreaming to be. Well, we identify ourselves, right, as being the eschatological Israel, right? This is why you are here. You have an eschatological concern. And you want to know, what does it mean? Why Elijah? So this is the point I want to elaborate, to ponder over tonight. There are a number of characteristics about this Elijah. I have noticed three characteristics. First one is a characteristic of reconciliation, of making peace between enemies. That's the purpose, that's the mission, one of the missions of the eschatological Israel, the Israel of the end. You, if you identify yourself as the eschatological Israel, your mission, and that's this mission which will make you eschatological Israel again. You are not eschatological Israel because you happen to have been born, you know, in a Seventh-day Adventist cradle. All right? You are eschatological Israel because of the mission, which is eschatological. It is the mission, again, which makes you eschatological. So, Elijah, you want to be Elijah. You identify yourself with Elijah. What does it mean? So that's the question. First question, first answer is, this coming of Elijah is associated with reconciliation, with bringing enemies together. How shall I say, first of all, before I go there? I would say, first of all, if I read the text, the way the text is given to us, it describes this Elijah, this mission of Elijah, as a mission made of a tension. Okay, I'm using now the word tension, made of a tension. And the first tension, of course, I have in fact anticipated the second one. I need to come back to what I was saying. I'm sorry, I have the flu, I have a fever, and I have all the excuses tonight. So, the mission of tension. One, tension. When you read the text, you can see that there is a tension. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb. And behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. In other words, when you read the text, you have an association of two missions. One is a mission which emphasizes remembering, bringing back to the past. Remember. Okay? So that's the first mission. Back to the roots. Actually, the word going back is used in the text. He goes back. Teshuvah, it's a mission. What characterizes really this eschatologically is that He is supposed to go back to the roots which has been forgotten, perhaps. Okay. Remember, go back to the past. So you have an emphasis on the past. But at the same time, you have also, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day. In other words, then you have the future. So the past, the root, and the future. Okay, so you have, this is the first tension which we have not often well understood. Okay, Christianity has defined itself, identified itself with a movement which is just to the future. But what the text is saying is that this eschatological Israel is not just a movement which is talking about the future, but is also a movement which is talking about the past, which reminds of something which has been forgotten, therefore remember. Okay, so that's the first tension. Remember, past, and hope, future. A second tension, I would say, is a tension which is a tension made of ethics, importance of the commandments of God, the law of God, And on the other hand, in other words, the emphasis, the focus is on the ground, on the earth, in your life, how you live, existence, ethics, commandments, the law of God. On the other hand, you have hope, eschatology, thinking of something which is beyond the earth. Right? So on one hand, you have it's a movement which identifies himself as being concerned with this earth. It's a movement which speaks about the law of God, and I could go even further and speak about creation, a movement which is concerned with the earth. Okay, and the word earth is used in our text, and we'll talk about that later. And on the other hand, is a movement who is in tune with another kingdom, a kingdom which actually denies the kingdom in which they are living, existence. So you have two tensions here. Okay? And, so, and the same tension, I believe, is indicated in Revelation 14, verse 12. Those who keep the commandments of God, so you have, this is the way Revelation 14 defines the eschatological, what we call the remnant, eschatological Israel, whatever you want to call it. Those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. It's interesting, by the way, that there are some comments by Ellen White which are significant of that tension. And I would like to just to mention this text here because I find it quite relevant and interesting. And when Ellen White actually is speaking about the very name Seventh-day Adventist, interesting, she is giving that particular characteristics which we are just talking about. And I'm just going to say, on the name Seventh-day Adventist, Ellen White comments, on the basis, by the way, of our text, Revelation 14, verse 12, that it is a distinctive name that adequately describes the ideal of the remnant people of God. And so they have both the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. This is the law and the gospel. And a few lines further, she again insists that the name, I'm quoting now, the name of Seventh-day Adventist carries the true features of our faith in front, which she explicitly identifies as God's law, and then the waiting of our Lord. So, as you can see, we can also recognize that particular feature, that particular tension. On one hand, the law, the remembering; on the other hand, the waiting of the kingdom of God. And according to Ellen White, of course, the very name Ellen, Seventh-day Adventist, of course, described that particular mission. Now, because of that tension which we are talking about between those two enemies, two movements, that is the law, and which we have forgotten, Christianity has forgotten, and the second coming. Because of that particular tension, we could say that the Seventh-day Adventist Church, in a way, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, the Israel of the end, would have a mission of reconciliation. Talking about the mission of reconciliation, by the way, Elijah, there are a number of elements, even in the biblical text, there is a story, a parable, which I cannot resist to tell you, which describes really the ministry of Elijah. One day a rabbi was on the place, and he was standing there, and Elijah appeared to him. And the rabbi asked Elijah, "Do you see someone on this place who would be saved, will be really the right Israel?" He said, "No, I don't see anyone." And then suddenly there are two people passing by. He said, "These two people, they are." So the rabbi is very intrigued. He approaches these two people and asks them, "What are you doing?" He says then, "Well, what we are doing is simply doing peace, reconciling, working on reconciliation between enemies. And this is why they are the right Israel." So So in other words, one of the characteristic feature of the Israel of God, so to speak, is to work on reconciliation. Reconciliation between what has been separated in Christianity, and when you look at the history of Christianity and Judaism, we can say that they have been separated. I don't agree with my friend Gerhard Fendel when he says, well, the Sabbath of the Jews are a wrong Sabbath. And then we take the example of the New Testament, but there is much more than the New Testament which talk about the Sabbath. Actually, there is something, and I'm talking about, of course, the Jewish literature. There is something interesting, a little of an irony I found. Someone wrote about the Sabbath. One of our theologians wrote about the Sabbath. And he said, well, our Sabbath is different than the Sabbath of the Jews. And why? Because this is the Sabbath of the Gospel. And then, in order to prove his point, he started quoting extensively from Abraham Heschel. Well, which means then that perhaps in the Jewish understanding of the Sabbath, there is something that Seventh-day Adventists can learn. Okay? So, the Sabbath, true, has been separated for a number of reasons, historical included from the coming of the Messiah. Okay? And this is why we have two people, actually, who represent that kind of separation, that kind of inimity. On one hand, we have the people who speak about the Sabbath, the law, emphasize the value of the law, and on the other hand, you have people who emphasize, Jesus. But in the history, what happens is that the one who spoke about Jesus destroyed the law, and the one who spoke about the law didn't take in consideration Jesus. And so I'm taking a shortcut here, of course, what is one of the mission of the Seventh-day Adventist people, of that kind of movement, is to bring up a reconciliation. Not just theological reconciliation, which is not easy, by the way. I think John Pauline mentioned that one, the difficulty we have to deal with grace. And the reason why we have the difficulty to deal with grace is because of the law. But I can reverse the problem. We have also a difficulty to deal with the law. And you know why? Because of grace. So, this is not easy to digest. This is not grace and law, and we haven't really progressed very much in that kind of reflection. We have not really produced, there is maybe one or two has tried to do something, but really a theology which really brings the two together in tension. Alright, so, but this is, because what happens, even in our church, you have people who are talking about grace and then they are not interested in the law, or you have people who are interested in law and they are not interested in grace, and our church is divided in that sense. But that kind of tension, this is what characterizes, so it's also a tension which is carried theologically, but it's not just something which is theological, but it's also something which is historical. It's a part of our mission to try to reconcile the two people who have been representing the two entities. So that's, and there is another reconciliation I want to add to that, is the reconciliation between transcendence and immanence. And here I would like to add something, just a little footnote, which was like John Pauline perhaps coming through my mind when during the night of 2 o'clock in the morning, so maybe it's a part of my delirium too. So when you read the text of which we have here of Malachi 4, you have on one hand the accent, the focus on transcendence before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Oh, this is not the little Jesus you were, little baby Jesus, which we can tame and manipulate, Dreadful day. Because this God is not a God we joke with. This is what the text is talking about. It's talking about a transcendent God. A God which we cannot manipulate. A God which we cannot understand, who is beyond our understanding, and actually should raise our fear. It's the dreadful God, but at the same time is immanence. On one hand, you are talking about the God who crushes you, who is beyond you, the great God, the God of the future. As on the other hand, you are talking about a God who is living in your life, the God of flesh, who has come down. And you have that kind of Elijah message, tension between immanence and transcendence. And I have to say, just as was making my little scratch with regards to the Sabbath in connection to the Jews, I'm going to make another scratch in connection to the Muslims. When I grew up among Muslims. I was born and grew up next to a mosque. I saw them all the time. My best friends were Muslims, so I know who they are for the good and for the bad. And I have seen great things in Islam. But I see also a number of scary things in Islam. I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda. I'm talking about the Islam I have known, really. So when you talk about Islam, there is an element in Islam which I believe has not been yet well understood in a Seventh-day Adventist church. Or you may think that you are the right person, the right remnant, but there is something there which we have missed, and that is the sense of the transcendence of God. And I think I agree with you, and you can talk whatever you want and try to justify what the sense of transcendence, which I see, which I saw in Islam, I did not see so much in our midst, which is very much influenced by evangelicals, right? Well, you just go and see our worship services, okay, and see yourself, right? The transcendence of God has completely, has disappeared. And so there is something here, I believe, which we can learn from the Muslims. I'm not saying again that they have something we don't have, because we are supposed to have it. That's the problem. Right, we'll come back to that. There is another reconciliation, I believe, which is implied in our text, and which is supposed to be brought along by this eschatological Israel. And that is the reconciliation with God. No, and it's interesting that at the end we are talking about, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. And you may want to, dig a little bit this text. And there is an element here which implied, well, if God doesn't come, then there is a curse on the earth. So there is a cosmic function, a cosmic action here. The God is reconciled with the earth. Because so far, it's not the case, my friends. Just look around yourself. You don't see God. So this message, eschatological message, is supposed to bring the answer to that problem. Now, I have a few minutes left to speak about the place of the Jewish people. I'm going to do it very quickly. It's expected to be here. And we could say that, there are two arguments which are, well, let's say like this, that the dispensationalist people are saying, well, Israel, the state of Israel, is a part of the plan. All right, is a part of the plan. Actually, it's the fulfillment of prophecy. So let me just address very quickly this issue. Two reasons, actually, a political, historical reason and a biblical, theological one. The political, historical reason, I have to say that Zionism is a modern political movement that has roots in Theodor Herzl, who was a secular Jew, was raised in the spirit of the Enlightenment. He didn't have any biblical vision. First, he believed that the Jewish problem would be solved, through tolerance. Christians and Jews would tolerate each other. And then he, as a journalist, he was a journalist, and he saw in France what happened in the story in connection to the Dreyfus affair, and he understood that it was not possible, and therefore he said, no, we need a land. And he wrote a book which is called Alt Neue Land, that is the old and new land, which is totally secular. It's a secular, it actually expresses a secular socialist view. So the Zionist dream was to be achieved in the arena of international politics in 1948, and from a secular perspective, and so forth. And as a background, of course, some people are saying the Nazi Holocaust, but it's more than that. I know that, this is the case of Iran these days. The president said, well, the Holocaust never existed. Because why? The Holocaust is the background of the history of Israel, which is not right, which is not correct, because this is forgetting the pain, the history of suffering the Jews had in Muslim countries. And I think we should be careful not to have too much of a romantic view about the history of Islam. It is true that the Jews lived better in Islam, but this was not a honeymoon anyway. And we have actually the beginning of Islam started with the mass massacres of several tribes, several Jewish tribes. And the Jews were completely, many thousands of Jews were killed, massacred, or forced to convert. And not only for the Jews, but also for the Christians, North Africa and so forth, became Muslims. So, that was a little parenthesis here. The background of Israel is Nazi atrocities, but also, of course, the Arabic story, Arabic history, and especially these days in the wake of Arab nationalism in 1870, when the Jews had to leave. Most of the Jews cannot live in a Muslim country. Okay, so historical and political justification, so it doesn't work because it's just secular. Then about prophecy, all right, biblical prophecy. When you look at the prophecies which are submitted to us, and I have looked at all of them with all the desire I had, honestly, they do not stand serious exegesis. There is no biblical prophecy which concerns Israel. I'm just taking a shortcut here, and so as far as dispensationalism, I should say, sometimes it pertains to me when I read that to science fiction, but also, many Jews actually, when they read, when they listen to the dispensationalist scenario, they are very afraid. Actually, they are afraid that they are being treated as marionettes in a mechanical end time scenario again. All right. So, and even so, I would say, even if we could rejoice with the with the creation of the state of Israel, and I do, because I identify myself with its history, and I rejoice with that. Even if we could rejoice, even if we believe that God was a part of that, which is very possible. Every American believes that God was a part of the creation of the United States. Why not the Jews? All right. So this, even if you believe that the hand of God was there, and we could recognize that to a certain extent, even if God could use Israel for His purpose, all right, does it mean that Israel is the fulfillment of prophecy? And I like the wise observation by Abraham Heschel, who says the state of Israel is not the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies, but it makes the messianic promise plausible. And I have seen that the state of Israel plays a role in another prophecy, which is the only one which we have concerning the Jewish Israel. And that is the conversion of many Jews at the end of time. And that's another. That's the only prophecy which I see is clear. We can see that in the book of Hosea. We can see that in Romans 11. And of course, Ellen White uses these two texts. And I just doing very quickly here in my book, Mystery of Israel, I elaborate and explain these things. So it's true that the conversion of many Jews is a part of eschatological Israel. So, and by the way, and that's quite interesting, the Jews are the only group, there is not another one, which are a part of prophecy when it comes to their conversion. You could see, of course we see that, we know that many people will convert, but the Jews are the only one who are clearly, explicitly identified by prophecy. That is quite interesting. I would like to conclude now. I would like to conclude on Elijah. And I would like to take another text that John Pauline has mentioned for our last reflection. And that is to help us realize our identity, our mission, and yet do it with humility and with caution, and not with arrogance. The word arrogance was used. It's interesting that when Elijah, the great prophet Elijah, who had all the power, miracles, came to God, I mean, I'm referring to 1 Kings 19, verse 18, this Elijah said, "I am the only one left." And God told him then, "No, you are not the only one. There are still 7,000. Well, God was not, of course, talking about pleading for pluralism. He was not saying, "Oh, you can find the truth also, in worshipping Baal." Because when you read the text here, it's very clear. These are people who will not bow before Baal. But they are not Elijah. So if you identify yourself with Elijah, be careful. Not think that you are the only one. The only person who can think that he is the only one, or who can think that he is the one who is the most beautiful person, is the person who does not go out from his bathroom. Because he's just looking at himself. And of course, when you're just looking at yourself, you're not exposed to Islam, you're not exposed to Judaism, you may come up, "Well, we have the only truth and the superior truth." But if you are exposed to other truth, then you think and you realize that perhaps out there, there is something which could help me understand and enrich my personal truth, which will make me the Israel of the end.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2007, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.